As we were coming back home, the neighbour called to ask where the hell we were. We pulled in, we got out of the car, and the alarms were blaring over at the army base. The military were evacuating. It's just
when
like...
when those guys bog off, you follow, or you're an idiot.
And thankfully we weren't a week later with our holidays, otherwise we probably could have been on the beach in Malakuta with everybody else.
What you don't talk about is what clothes you might take, what are your favourite clothes that you don't want to leave behind, what are the family heirloom things, not just the photos, but other things, the conducting baton that belonged to my grandfather, that kind of stuff.
You're listening to From the Embers, a nine-part series exploring the effects of the 2019 bushfire season. In South Australia, fires erupted across the state, destroying homes, livestock and bushland. From the York Peninsula, northwest of Adelaide, to Kangaroo Island, and all the way down to Kilara, towards the Victorian border. Over 240,000 hectares of land was burnt. Towns in the Adelaide Hills are connected through a web of winding scenic routes. Views change as quickly as the townships, rocky hillsides, fruit orchards and valleys that lead to the freeway, straight down to the city.
It's beautiful, the people are friendly, and there's so much less traffic.
Quiet, except for you can hear the cow farm in the distance. First move up to the hills was just because it was cheaper and it was easier to find houses that would allow our cats.
Yeah, just as he said, initially it was because it was cheap, but I'd never move back to Adelaide. I can't even stand driving in Adelaide now, never mind living there.
Each town is known for something. Woodside for its chocolate factory, Birdwood for its motor museum, and Lobethal for the biggest community display of Christmas lights in the Southern Hemisphere. But 5 days before Christmas, the lights went out.
It started like any other day. It was summer, so it was hot.
The Adelaide Hills are usually a place of cool refuge in the summer, but even they succumbed to the statewide heatwave, breaking the hottest December day on record on the 20th.
And I was over it because I hate summer. Luckily, like, I think your first job was like 7:30 in the morning.
Beck and Matt Edwards live in Woodside.
I work as a cleaner and odd jobs sort of guy for people who are elderly or physically disabled.
We went to that window clean, went to another job, and then I think the third one, I dropped him off.
Lovely Scottish lady, I remember that, because I was cleaning her windows while she's looking at the CFS website going, so you guys live in Woodside, are you going to be okay?
I checked my Facebook Messenger and I've got all these messages, oh my gosh, are you guys okay? Are you safe? Do you need someone to evacuate to? And it's like, why would we need to evacuate? What?
A fire had started in Cuddly Creek, about 20 minutes away from their home in Woodside.
Dude, guys, calm. Cuddly Creek is ages from here. If there's a fire, it'll take forever to get here. That was at 10:15 that I started getting all those messages. By the time I'd driven from Mount Barker back home here to Woodside, which is like, what, a 22-minute drive, roughly? The fire had gone from Cuddly Creek to Woodside, which is kind of half the distance between the two locations, so... that was when I was like, oh, we actually may have to evacuate. The first time I got back, I'm like, I'm not leaving. I am staying. I'm defending my home because I've been homeless twice before. And I thought, shit, I can't cope with the idea of being homeless again.
Now, if there was an emergency, my wife would come and get me. So she rocks up in the four-wheel drive and says, get in the damn car. We need to get back and start loading stuff into the four-wheel drive. So it turns out the nice old Scottish lady was right.
There was a smell of smoke. Everything was grey, but if you looked towards Lobethal, it was like this grey-pink twister. It was apocalyptic and there was burnt leaves falling from the sky. I just kept waiting for someone to step out from behind a tree and go, cut, because it looked like a movie. It was insane.
They rushed home to pack. Clothing, laptops, DVDs, food, And of course, the cats. They weren't the only ones. It seemed like the whole town was evacuating.
As we were coming back home, the neighbour called to ask where the hell we were, and Matt's just like, we're turning right in now. We pulled in, we got out of the car, and the alarms were blaring over at the army base. The military were evacuating. It's
when
just like,
when those guys bog off, you follow, or you're an idiot. I remember sticking the sprinklers on, and there's this sort of ash stuff falling out of the sky, and then this bird, a lorikeet, I think, one of the small grass parrots, was covered in soot and slightly smoking, and it landed itself under the sprinkler right at my feet.
I actually had been in Mount Barker at the time at a mosaic group. I turned up and a friend texted me and said, oh, I just heard on the radio the fire's got to Lobethal. So I said to everyone, I'm off, I'll see you, and headed home. Came home and we started packing things up and getting ready and sort of in a panicked evacuation, really. Not really very organised.
Kaz and her husband, Kiffin, live in Bahana, a 10-minute drive from Woodside.
Didn't see any smoke. In fact, we seem to be in a bit of a valley here. Where we live is a bushfire safer zone. So that tends to make one feel safe. I mean, all that really means that in a fire front, it's got to get through a few houses to get to us. But nobody's safe from ember attack.
The fires were travelling fast.
When it got to Woodside, it was scary because then it all depended on wind direction. That's not far at all. That's kind of next door practically. It all depended on the winds and the way the fires were so fierce. Could see that.
They packed the car.
Right, what do we need to be doing? Kind of preparing outside, and we're packing things up and loading them into vehicles and the cats. And we'd rung his sister, which is where we'd planned on going for an evacuation, to say, we're coming, we're on our way. Wasn't sort of panicked, but was focused. Probably a touch of panic, but...
And within minutes, we're on their way to her sister-in-law's house, about an hour away.
We headed up the freeway rather than down to town. Where we went was near Murray Bridge. So we didn't know till we got to where we were going that in actual fact, Balhanna had been red zoned, probably as we were leaving.
There are three colour zones reflecting an escalation in warnings. Red is the highest level of risk to life and property. This is when you'll hear that it's too late to leave. If packing had taken longer, Kaz and Kiffin would have had to take shelter in their home. This was their second evacuation in 4 years. The first was during the Sampson Flat fires, which burned uncontrolled for 4 days, destroying homes, vineyards and properties across more than 12,000 hectares.
One of the things that struck me as curious is with both evacuation experiences, I took completely different things each time.
We ourselves personally had only just returned from being on holidays, ironically. We'd had to deal with, in Victoria and New South Wales, dodging fires anyway while we're on holidays. Thankfully, we weren't a week later with our holidays. Otherwise, we probably could have been on the beach in Mallacoota with everybody else. My name is Meg Stevens and we are in Mount Pleasant. We've been fairly lucky in that because we're a bit further out, it's not as rugged a landscape, so you don't have the effect of the fires going up the hills rapidly. But we are close to forestry. Mount Crawford Forest is only a couple of kilometres away, really, which if you've got a real firestorm, that's a very real hazard.
Mount Pleasant, where Meg and her husband live, was about 30 minutes from where the fire started in Cuddly Creek.
We hadn't even unpacked when the fire started, and my husband was in the city, so I said to him, we've been told to watch an act, so I'm packing up. Got a policy now, I've got one pet that I keep inside when it's that sort of day. I said that I can find him, you know, when I need to pack up. I evacuated and my husband with me. We had to make a fairly zigzag route further north because we couldn't go straight down the normal way.
That's one of the things about living in the hills when you evacuate is your route and knowing that a lot of people are going to be taking the freeway, so if you can avoid that, that's better. But then, of course, you don't want to be going through fire grounds. Particularly in the hills, there's lots of horse floats and that sort of thing, and so you might be trying to share the road with some pretty heavy-duty traffic and a lot of people who are a bit worried and a bit scared, and so you've got to take all that into account, and it's a good reason to leave early. You know, you talk about a kit, you talk about making sure you've got anybody's medicines, any pet medicines, that sort of thing. You talk about having clothes that you can cover yourself with. There's all sorts of things you have in an emergency kit. What you don't talk about is what clothes you might take. What are your favourite clothes that you don't want to leave behind? What are the family heirloom things, not just the photos, but other things, the conducting baton that belonged to my grandfather, that kind of stuff. There was a woman on the radio who said that her husband grabbed his record collection and she grabbed, I think it was the pets and knickers. And I love those kind of stories because that's been my experience too, is that there's a chaoticness about it when you think you're prepared, but you're actually kind of not too.
And if you add in the pressure of ensuring you have a good car, a full tank of petrol, enough food to get you through a week, when you're living on a budget, choices are limited.
In terms of working out where we might go for evacuation, we have a number of family and friends who've offered, and they know that that comes with cats. If you have to pay for accommodation, you're not necessarily going to be able to bring the animals too. That would have been really difficult. So that's an added little level that's just there. One of the things I struggled with, being poor, not being well off, you can buy stuff, that you, a spray you can get that calms animals down, but it's expensive. And so you're kind of, you're torn, what do I do? Do I get this stuff? Do I not get this stuff? And can I afford it really is what it comes down to.
Beck and Matt also live on a low income. On the day of the fires, they borrowed a four-wheel drive.
We were really lucky that the car was full of fuel because the bank was closed as well. I went into the bank that morning to try and get some money out, and it was closed because it was catastrophic fire danger day. And if we hadn't have had fuel in the car and had the people available to us to say, here, come stay with us, we probably would have been sleeping in the car. If it was just me, I probably would have been screwed. I probably would have ended up on my dad's kitchen floor in his housing trust house. But we are also really, really blessed in the friends that we have, and our prayer group, the people who host it, said that anyone who needs space can come and evacuate to their house. I honestly, for a few minutes, was determined to stay and die fighting it if I had to. In hindsight, I would have been fine, but that day, we had no idea where it would have gone. Like, we're really lucky. We got really, really lucky.
But it's not just a roof over your head that you need when evacuating. It's also new tyres to drive safely.
The ones that my father-in-law had on the car were not exactly road legal.
I mean, they weren't just bald, they were cracking, so.
So that set us back about 650, which was most of what we had on us.
And there are others who are at risk in an emergency too.
As I say, a lot of my clients are older or physically disabled. One of the women who I clean for, their house is still standing, but the burned section of trees comes like within my shoulder width of the house. If her sister hadn't have been there, she probably would have died of smoke inhalation because she could not physically leave the property.
After the fires pass and the adrenaline leaves your body, it's back to normal life. But that isn't always an easy transition.
Spent $200 on hoses and sprinklers and money we probably couldn't have spent but did anyway on just being able to keep all of the yard wet at once if we need to again. So I don't know whether that's helping us settle in or sleep easier, but it certainly works for me.
The first couple of weeks after the fires, one of the first things we would do in the morning is set the sprinklers going. And then I'd come home in the middle of the day and set them going for another hour. And then we'd do it again that night just to make sure everything was wet, everything was damp, everything was green, nothing could burn. For the first 3 weeks after we came back, I was waking up every hour, 2 hours. Oh my God, we're going to burn to death. Check CFS. Oh, okay, we're good. Back to sleep. And then again, you know, another two or three times before I wake up. One night I saw an orange glow over to the east of here, and it was like 2 in the morning and we had to be up at 6 for a shift. And Matt was like, it's nothing. We're going back to bed. And I'm like, what if it's a fire that no one else has seen yet? So I drag him out there and we go for a quick drive around some of the blocks. And it turned out it was just fog and orange straight lines. And I mean, Matt was angry about it. I was kind of frustrated. But at the same time, at least we weren't ignoring what could have been another fire, because there were so many fires reigniting afterwards, because the initial fire went through, burnt everything, the trees dropped all of their leaves, and that was like another whole layer of ready-to-go fuel for fires. It was awful.
And now, months after the fires,
I still have nightmares about the smell. I used to love the smell of wood smoke, but the fires took over a month to get out, and there was still smoke. For like every time I smelled smoke after those fires, I panicked. I still panic now. And it used to be something that, you know, end of a cold day in winter, we'd sit back, hot chocolate, kick our feet up and enjoy the wood fire. I don't know that I'd be able to do that again.
I went outside, I think I was hanging the clothes or something, and I saw a helicopter overhead. And I started to panic. And then I saw two more helicopters and I started to really panic. And I ran inside, saying to my husband, who was about to head off to band practice, I said, you're not going anywhere. We may have to evacuate. There's helicopters outside. The Tour Down Under is coming through here at the moment. Oh, that's what the helicopters were. And they weren't red either. I think from memory, most of the water bombing helicopters were red. So, oh, okay. Good. I was surprised at how much I panicked. I really got quite distressed.
So it wasn't until, well, really mid-March that I felt was actually out of danger time, because things are so dry in the hills. For a while afterwards, as many, many weeks afterwards, before I actually unpacked the stuff from the car and unpacked the bag of clothes and things like that.
Initially, when we first got back, we just left everything in the vehicles. I finally got to a point where I got sick of running out to the van every day to get a fresh pair of knickers. I thought, I've really got to bring some in. This is getting silly. We were both talking about how our relationship with our stuff has altered, because we both tended to be hoarders. And now we're suddenly rethinking that in a different way. And letting go of stuff more than we've ever been able to before. And we both commented we feel like this is a permanent shift, not just an immediate reaction. It's been interesting. It feels deep.
It's changed my relationship with stuff. I'm going through all my books and going, yep, I've read this. I'm never going to read this again. It can go to the op shop. Just so I've got less stuff to sort of sift through and deal with if we ever have to evacuate again.
I've started passing on heirlooms more. Now, we had a dome clock that came down through the generations through the female line. I've passed that on to my nieces who live in town. And it's something I didn't want to have to think about if I have to evacuate, because it's fragile. And I'm thinking about other family heirloom stuff, like, do I really want to hold on to it? Do I want to have to worry about it if we evacuate? Or do I pass it on now to someone? It's kind of curious, but it really shifts your thinking in so many ways. Those of us who've been more closely impacted, how we prepare next summer will shift. I don't know. I know for me, I can't imagine next summer going back to the old normal at all. This brought it home in a way that nothing ever did, and I don't imagine I'd be the only person feeling that way.
Made me more aware of what's important. You just look at all the things you've got and look at them differently. Okay, it's practical possessions that are more important when you're actually evacuating. What if I did lose everything? What would happen next? But I know that I've got lots of friends around that would be supportive, and that's more important.
People have a much larger perspective than, you know, what they have. They look at also what they could have lost, and they're grateful for what they've managed to retain through it.
We may all become a bit more minimalist. I'm not sure. I remember talking to one guy who I barely knew his wife better, and he was talking about how the fire got to next door and he barely got out alive and he was getting distressed. So I just gave him a hug. This is someone I wouldn't normally have that kind of relationship with, but in this situation, everything shifts a little.
How did he respond when you hugged him?
Well, hugged me back. All got a bit teary because I think he needed that. He needed that level of connection because that's who we are as people. We're supposed to connect closely. If people don't touch or aren't touched for long periods of time, there's a thing they call skin hunger. It's a biological thing about, so was it they say you should have 12 hugs a day or something, which seems like an awful lot, even in a warm relationship. But that's part of who we are, that connectedness, that being known, I think, is something we all crave, feeling like people know who we are, who we really are deep down, and accept it and love it. We're all connected, but the polite veneer covers that. And when that polite veneer is shifted aside a bit, not torn apart, just shifted a little, because you're all kind of like, we're all experiencing this together. It's kind of like you can see the connectedness in a way that you don't normally, but it's always there, I think. I think it's good we hear the stories of people who've been in similar situations to us in similar worlds that we live in. I think that's good. It reminds us that we're not isolated. You connect by just hearing each other's stories and laughing together. I've been to a few funerals lately, and people have gotten up and told stories about the departed person. And we all come together, so like, yeah, that's the person I know. I recognise that, or I didn't know that about that person, but it makes sense with the bits I did know. And all of that is part of reminding us that we're part of something bigger. In fact, we're supposed to be part of something bigger.
The fires in the Adelaide Hills consumed over 23,000 hectares and destroyed homes, vehicles, properties and forests. People sustained serious injuries. There was one fatality.
We actually knew the man that passed away over near Charleston, as did a lot of people. We went to his funeral celebration. There was about 800 people there in Harndorf. He was a much-loved friend. I worked with him for 6 months. So that sort of brought home also how easy it is to get caught.
Ron Selth died defending his home in Charleston.
I remember when I read out my poem for Ron Selth to Club Acoustica.
He was known as a passionate and intelligent man who gave wholehearted hugs.
After the funeral itself, a number of us, because Ron was part of the folk scene, among other things, quite a number of us went back to his partner's place. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and we played an old gospel song, I'll Fly Away, which is a really beautiful song about dying and going to heaven. And the bird life had all gone to bed hours ago because it was so dark. But when we sang that song, there was a galah, and it circled around us, squawking in time to the song. And then at the end of the song, he did this big, long squawk and then flew off into the night. And we all just looked at each other and said, well, that was Ron saying goodbye. At the funeral, I heard more about this guy, and to write about somebody I didn't quite get to know and wanted to. It was interesting writing around the edges of experience. How do you mourn something that never actually was?
Is that one that you shared with the family, with his family?
No, I haven't. I must pass it on to them, actually. Yeah, I've shared it with other people who knew him. Teary nods, vigorous nods. I read it out at a live music club. And they were like, yeah, that's true. You did miss out on those hugs.
I might be putting you on the spot here. I was wondering whether you might recite your poem that you've been telling me about.
The one about Ron? I'll have to go get it. Oh, wrong glasses. Sorry.
That's all right.
So, this is called Mourning Ron. It's for Ron Self, who died in the Cuddly Creek fires. Ripped off, robbed, cheated, gazumped. I only just connected with you. Thought, well, now there's an interesting bloke. I'd like to get to know you some more. And then gone. Just like that. I got to know you more, sure, at your funeral. An interesting bloke, all right. I don't get to experience having my bones crushed by your exuberant whole heart hugs. I don't get to see the intense, intentional, different each time moves of Dancing Man. I don't get to experience the stimulating conversations I might have had with a passionate, highly intelligent, rule-breaking, risk-taking eccentric. At the after party, after the wake, it was 10 o'clock. We all sang I'll Fly Away. A lone cockatoo circled above us, screeching in time to that old gospel number, then flew off with a final prolonged screech. I was there for your final goodbye. You're not here for the friendship we might have had. How do you mourn what wasn't?
You've been listening to From the Embers. This series has been brought to you by the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia and is supported by the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas and the Paul Ramsey Foundation. Our guests were Beck and Matt Edwards, Kaz and Meg Stevens. A special thanks to Thea Taylor, Miranda Hampton, Adelaide Hills Community and Radio Adelaide. The producer was Lisa Burns.
That dome clock that you passed on to your nieces, do you feel like a part of you has gone with that dome clock, or is do you feel quite free not having that on you?
I'm a little sad to see it not where it was, but I feel good that it's safe. Well, hopefully.
Engineering by Tegan Nichols. Script consultation by Zoe Ferguson. Theme music by Oliver Beard. The production management team was Vicky Rouse and Abe Killian.
And the executive producer was Sarah Mashman.
This podcast was made on the lands of the Kaurna people and the Peramenk people and the Muwinina people from country around Nipaluna. These lands were never ceded.